am the Senior Multifaith Educator at Global Spiritual Life at NYU, and you are listening to Multifaithful, the podcast about religious diversity, multifaith dialogue, and effing the ineffable. Each week, we are joined by a guest who will share unique experiences with as a leader of multifaith. Whether it be in academics, politics, social justice, or even sports, we want to talk about different ways encounters with religious diversity shape our own religious and spiritual expression and our ideas about the world. Grandiose? Yeah, absolutely. But if we wanted to use the term effing the ineffable, we had to pick a topic that would be worthy. On this week's podcast, I am joined by Reverend Zenju Earthlin Manuel, a Zen Buddhist priest, author, and artist based in the Bay Area. We discuss her path from Christianity to Buddhism, the role of Buddhists within multi-faith work, and her own approach to difficult conversations about race, ethnicity, and sexuality. Thank you for tuning in to Multifaithful, and now to this week's conversation. I am joined today by Zenju Earthlin Manuel. She has a PhD in transformative learning from the California Institute of Integral Studies and is also an ordained Zen Buddhist priest. I'm also joined today by one of our student leaders here at NYU, Brian Young. Brian, introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Brian. I'm currently a sophomore in the College of Earth and Sciences, studying Metropolitan Studies, and I've been a part of the GSL office for coming up on a year now, I guess, as a worker, and then continuing as a worker, and then also as a member of MAC, the Multifaith Advisory Committee, and I'm also very much involved in the mindfulness aspect of this office's programming.
In reading your bio, I was struck by two things. One was you talking about kind of growing up Christian and the transition to Buddhism later in life, which I think like a transition between one religion and another is some sort of multi-faith that I'd love to discuss. Yes. And then two, I don't see many bios that read like personal value statements instead of listing off just like many, many amazing accomplishments, which you have. There's also a lot about how you see the world and approach the world. So maybe you could tell us why Buddhism became that avenue for you and how that fits together.
How I see the world?
Yeah.
Well, let's back up a little bit to what you said about transferring from Christianity to Buddhism, and to me it feels I brought my Christianity with me to the path. And before Buddhism, there was a little time I practiced Yoruba African traditions, and I didn't complete that. I was practicing it with Africans actually from Dahomey, and I didn't complete it because it felt like the practice needed to happen in Africa for me after having done it with them. And so I never could find the right place. And so Buddhism, I didn't go out looking for it. It just arrived through some friends. It was a gateway. And I actually wasn't interested in Buddhism or Buddha or anybody or anything about it. And but eventually, because of these friends who introduced me to the practice, I began to read some of the teachings. And in reading the teachings, I realized that I said, oh, this is God. This is God. And when I read it, and I said, this is what to find God in the Buddhist teachings was pretty much a revelation for me. I feel there's God in Jesus' teachings as well, but the way I was taught those teachings of Jesus weren't the way of love that I feel that Buddhism turns toward. And then a lot of people ask me about that. What happened, you know, to you and God, you know? And I said, it's still there, because for me, God is the love and Buddha is the love. And that's it. And they're definitely very different religions. I wouldn't say there's anything that's the same in that way, and how you practice it is different. So as I began to practice Buddhism, and I think that that's what I write in my bio, is I think I wanted people, when they read about me, not to see me, but to see how what I've learned you know, from my spiritual walk, and to talk about how I incorporated the notion of liberation and the notion of my own lived experience into the spiritual path, which is not easy to do in a country that is separate spirituality and life, you know, other like worldly life. So it was very hard to do. And so that became my quest, you know, to shape my spiritual path, you know, by the questions I had around my own life. And so that my bio reads that way to me is really about how I shaped my spiritual path as opposed to accomplishments.
So I wanna ask about liberation, because I know that many people talk about liberation theology or often find liberation through Christianity, and you seem to imply that you actually found it more in Buddhism. So can you tell us a little bit about how that happened or maybe why that was for you?
Yeah, and okay, it's a big question. I feel that, you know, I even talk about, I have a book called Tell Me Something About Buddhism as well that actually Thich Nhat Hanh wrote a foreword to. In that book, I talk about Christianity and how it too is a practice that people of African descent took on. It was a strange path. And the Africans, enslaved ones, had to shape that practice, you know, to fit what they were doing already from their own country and their own land. And so there was a particular things in Christianity that, you know, they had to add to. And so I practiced Christianity way into my adulthood, like into my, I think, 28, 29, it kind of stopped. But in that process, and then when I came over to Buddhism, I realized that a lot of what I felt was true for me as a Christian, and that I was already raised in this black church, was true also in Buddhism in terms of the teachings, not in terms of the organization itself or how they organized various centers, Buddhist centers. So one of the main things is generosity, which is a really important principle, and called one of the paramitas, was always part of just black culture, you know, because everyone had to be generous. And so if you had $2 and there were two of you, each one got $1, even if I didn't know you. Like if we were all hungry, I had $3, we would all go with our dollar and together, you know. And so it never felt like we were poor. So like if you didn't have shoes, you'd get shoes from somebody in the church, or a coat or a car or anything that you need to get into school. All of these kind of things were kind of done in this tribe, you know. So you never felt like you were poor, you know, and without anything. And so that has changed, of course, you know, over the years. And maybe there's a church out there like that, but most of them, probably have lost that kind of communal generosity. And then there's, speaking of communal, there's Sangha, and that's a big part of, you know, Buddhism. And so the Sangha, the church, was very important to my life, especially a child that I was part of the desegregation movement and ended up in schools and sometimes the only one who was black. And so having a black church, I think, definitely saved my life, that I had to go to every Sunday, Wednesday, and Thursday. You know, so I still was steeped in, you know, the culture, and then having, of course, a lot of family, you know, aunts and uncles and nieces, cousins, you know, everything. So the liberation in that, and you asked that question, I feel that liberation is the place in which we become aware of who we are, and at that point where we can accept it as it is, whatever we are. And we're not free when we're hiding from ourselves, you know. And I feel like Buddhism and sitting practice and meditation helped me to illuminate my life. And of course, a lot of things I saw I didn't like, you know, or and I realized a lot of things I hated about myself. And so having the practice helped me to come into that place that this is my life, and it is part of the true nature of everything. And when I came to that knowing, that wisdom, I began to have more compassion for myself for in understanding why I didn't really embrace myself because of the, you know, collective or systemic oppression in our world. And so I began to really understand liberation in that way, you know. And, you know, I can't, anything that says liberation, I tend to come to, you know. So, I'm there.
So we should have called this the Liberation Podcast.
Yes, yeah, I'm there. Yeah, I really, it's important internally and externally, yes.
So in The Way of Tenderness, your book, that we, well, the one that we're focusing on, at least for tonight's Sid and for the rest of this. You state that hatred remains potent, whether directed at a construct, an illusion, or at the reality of others. Therefore, identity should not be dismissed in our efforts towards spiritual awakening. So do you see this same sort of thought process played out in multi-faith work or in interfaith work? And if so, how? Because I think sometimes people look at multi-faith work and they say, you know, we're all human or we're all the same and that's, you know, that's what unites us. But in the end, you know, you have your multiplicity of oneness. Yeah. You know, it's the same thing in multi-faith work because you have all these religions coming together.
That's right.
And it's sort of, I don't know, you know, it's a different question, I guess. So
I feel like I just have a little dabble of interfaith, you know, kind of contact and work. But you're saying, you know, this kind of oneness, we are one and we're all on this path, you know, of peace and, you know, oneness and harmony. I feel that that kind of thinking and sometimes proselytizing eliminates our ability to speak around the differences, and especially if the differences within us has caused any kind of suffering between us. And so my book, In the Way of Tenderness, I needed to speak even for myself that the ways in which we are embodied, the various ways we are just as potent as this kind of non-dual thinking. And so I even go as far as to say non-duality is not supreme over duality. That non-duality and duality are it themselves, and they both exist. So, you know, so what happens is people try to be this spiritual being that is not necessary, because we don't need to become one. We are one. It's just like we don't have to become it. Mm-hmm. We don't have to work at it. We don't have to try to create a boundlessness between us. These things, to me, already exist, and because they exist, and we do too. That means that, to me, the multiplicity of us exists as well, and everything in it is part of everything, part of the path. And so when you open it up like that, it kind of makes people nervous, because it's like, okay, we're going to, if this is going to separate us, and if you bring this in, it's going to create, you know, tension. And I say the tensions are the perfect path. We need the tension to be on the path, because we would be asleep on the path if there weren't any, you know, in our lives. So we have to have these tensions. And I think we came embodied in these various ways so we could have them. I think it's a beautiful gift of creation, you know, to have all of this before us, whether it feels good or not, you know. And so we try to make it feel good. And we work on that part without becoming intimate with the suffering we have between us. And as people, and we also are afraid, you know, that, like I said, we're going to be divisive, it's going to be divisive or separate, create separations. I feel that separation also exists in oneness, and oneness exists in separation. So these are Buddhist teachings, you know. Mm-hmm. So I feel that I used those teachings to understand that it was okay to talk about my lived experience, But also, you know, not only just that, but to bring the teachings to that experience. So it's difficult, you know, because some people, you know, will have one eyebrow up, you know, even about what I'm talking about. Because I'll say, if you're ignoring, you know, race, sexuality, and gender, and class, and so on, then you're ignoring the oneness. And they're like, you know, well, I'm here doing my practice, so how could I be, you know? And I think it's hard to sustain a spirituality or a religion without bringing your whole self there, you know, that your lived experience. You can't sustain it. You'll slip out the back door with that kind of thing you're hiding, or slip out the back door with the tension, you know, you might be having with people in the community, or a teacher or minister or anything. We have to have that, and I think it will make our religions and our past more integral and more honest. Yeah, a lot of more integrity. I was kind of mixing integral. That's an interesting word coming forth. But
is that going to be a new book title?
Yeah. Yeah.
So then sort of going back to what you were saying about having tools and knowing, you know, well, not knowing when is appropriate to use them, but just sort of assessing a situation. The way I translate that is sort of, that's why mindfulness and meditation are sort of important, because it allows you to step back and look at everything, and you know, it not even for the advantage of being able to say, well, this is what I can do now, just sort of to be able to react appropriately, I guess.
So mindfulness and meditation are meant for you to explore your inner world, you know, your inner life. It doesn't mean step back. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not, okay, something's happening, so I'm going to go into this moment of meditation or mindfulness. Because mindfulness and meditation, you have to step forward into it, into that fire. You know, even if you practice that in meditation and mindfulness, stepping into the fire of your own life. So once you begin to learn how to step into your own fire, you know, then when the fire shows up over here, you go, I know that fire. And I know how it feels. I would know how it feels if someone said this, and I would know how it feels if someone said that. And I would know, you know, how to enter this fire with everyone and be in it with everyone, not observing it. There's a fire over there. You understand you're in a fire? You understand you're angry? You know? Yeah. It's kind of, you know, a kind of objective place again, you know, observing the other, the external. So it's important not to, I think that's what frightens activists, is that it's, oh, if I go to mindfulness and meditation, that means I have to be passive. Mm-hmm. So then they're doing the active work, and then they go sit, and it feels different. Because one, it's hard to trust that sitting is going to affect anything outside of us, but it does. But we can't always see it. It does affect who you know, outside of us. Mm-hmm. Now, the complete revolution of the country all at once, we know is might not be happening through that. And we don't only need mindfulness and meditation. Mm-hmm. We need more than that. That's one aspect that we can use that's very powerful. I was talking the other day. I said we can... sometimes I take students for a walk in the park. And we're doing meditation walk, and some people show up, at, you know, oh, I want to do a walk in the park with you. You know, that sounds nice. And then they like getting to going, walking in the park. I said, no, we're not walking like that. We're going to walk very, very slow in this really kind of slow meditation in Zen we call Kingen. And it's very slow, like one step. It takes a long time to get one step because you're doing a breathing method. So we're walking through the park like that. Looks like we're in slow motion, you know, and everybody's running by, and they're on their bike, and they're looking at us, you know, like, what? And it's very interesting how that affects the people that go by, though. And just to show you how it can affect, most people who go by drop into the same place we are as they go by. Mm. They get very quiet. They walk slower. And then they go on by. But then they have just been taught meditation in that moment, without us saying a word. They have practiced with us in one moment, and they have felt us. And I think that that's what's important, you know, that we're learning to, how do we feel each other? Is it you know, enough trust for what's happening. Then there were some people who wanted to disturb it. It wasn't just those who, you know, they didn't care. They're louder than loud, you know. So we can affect each other. And I've learned to trust my practice as the place in which I can bring just my part, you know, to... And I feel like in doing that, I bring others with me, so it's not just me, you know. It becomes collective. I wouldn't have students, and I always consider them more like apprentice or spiritual fellows along the way, spiritual companions who are coming with me to explore and look into this world and try to, you know, understand each other, you know. If we have a lot of goals of trying to be better, then we might get out of the group. Or we have a lot of goals of trying to, you know, not have any what we might think is non-Buddhist behavior, then, you know, they're going to leave the group. If we have people who have come in and they don't understand, you know, anything about the meditation and they're tired breathing quietly, they will leave because nothing is there to ground the breathing. They're just breathing, and that's pretty boring. I always tell people that's a boring meditation. That's boring Buddhism, you know. Just that, you know, because if you don't know what you're really doing, it doesn't. It seems simple, but you have to really know what you're doing. Everyone still can just sit, and they got it. Pow! I'm in. I'm Buddhist. Or I'm in the Dharma. I know how to meditate. Some people even teach it, you know, after they've taken one class of meditation, one or two class. You can teach people to sit and be quiet, maybe, and breathe along, but it won't be sustained over time. It'll get boring. It won't have, there will be no understanding of what you're doing and why you're doing it. And then the more your life shows up, the worse it gets, so you definitely will stop, you know, if you don't have teachings to ground it in your life and be guided, you know, by someone or something.
It strikes me as that I feel like in the United States and on college campuses, I think, we often, when we think about like religious diversity or interfaith or multifaith, we so often focus on Abrahamic religions or Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Yeah. And the type of religious leader who can be successful in that type of environment sounds very different than the type of religious figure you're describing. It's a much different orientation to building a community or building a solution to a problem. Uh-huh. I think it's really interesting. It's like almost a different model to what we're talking about, or a slightly different orientation that maybe Buddhism has to lend that most people here are not as familiar with. Because yeah. I think most Americans are just less familiar with Buddhism.
Yes, they are. But it's also a growing practice. Mm-hmm. You know, for many people... one, you can practice it with other and still have another religion. I met many Christians in the center, yeah. In the Zen center, and so you can, you know, have both, depending if you're not going to get confused, because there are places in which maybe your Christian church would say no, you can't do that part of Buddhism. So I would say Buddhism is not looking to bring people in. You know, that's they just open a door, and if people come, that's good. That's it. So it's not interested in necessarily influencing others to take on the teachings. And I think sometimes that freedom in it allows people to kind of take on meditation and quietly and secretly, maybe, some people. And not feel, you know, too bad about it, you know, not going against their practice. I'm learning through other people who have other practices, and myself too, knowing some of this, is that many religions and spiritual path meditations included anyway. It's just a different kind of meditation. Yeah, it's there, and it has to be, to me, in some way, in order to... be awake to what's being taught. So in some way, they may not call it meditation, there may be some particular component of the religion or spirituality that has the same quality as meditation or they actually don't call it meditation. You know, they call it something else. But in many practices, it's part of it. I think it's just, I see it more and more, and Christian churches are talking about it more. They won't say it's Buddhism, but I do. I know it is. You know, it's like, what? That's okay. That's all right. As long as it's there, you know, as long as it's coming in there somehow, because it doesn't have to be, you know, I don't think it has to be done all the same way. You know, it has to fit the people, you know, which is different. That's very different than other paths. You know, you have to do things a particular way. I know I did, you know, as being part of the Church of Christ. You know, you had to do particular things and not other things. So I think that's the freedom. I've seen people do that with Buddhism, though, Christianize Buddhism, you know, or make it... you know, it's a sin to, you know, it creates sins. They don't say the word, but, you know, it's like, oh, if you're a Buddhist, you shouldn't be doing that, you know, and there's no such thing as that. There really isn't no such thing. That's how liberated it is. There are precepts that we take vows when you're getting ordained. You take vows, and they are centered around precepts, and you might avoid killing, avoid lying, sexual misconduct, intoxication, you know, all of these kinds of things. But those aren't not the, just like the Ten Commandments. I think they're similar. And I think the Ten Commandments, maybe in some ways, maybe they became moral rule. But I think probably initially they're more probably like the precepts, in which there's just a guide. This is how, if you want to live a liberated and awake life, and one that that matches the beauty and the magnificence of the nature of life, then you will follow these kind of guide. This is a guideline for life, and that's the beauty of I think precepts, and also if the Ten Commandments could be really revisited and practiced in that way, I think a lot of people will understand Christ as well.
Yeah, I completely agree, because I came from a Catholic background, into Catholic tradition, into Buddhism, and that's what I liked so much, was that, you know, you sort of, if you trust yourself enough with the practice and with the Dharma and everything, you can trust yourself enough to just make decisions in your life that don't necessarily require someone else to say, you know, don't do this. It's, you know, you just... I don't know. It's a feeling almost.
Or make you sad if you do it. You know, and grieved and worried and afraid, you know. It took a long time for me to deprogram that kind of, you know, way of thinking about God and, you know, Christ. I think if I had stayed even in Christianity, I probably wrote the same book. But I think it'd be the same book. I'm trying to understand these things in a broader perspective, because I could hear myself sometimes going, no, I don't think Jesus meant that, you know, you know, I don't think so, you know, and often had a few debates.
Well, thank you so much. I definitely learned a ton, especially as someone who is Jewish and comes from what you were just describing as being very cognizant of hell in a very particular way to view the world is something that I very much grew up with and still have some sort of attachment to. And it's always interesting to learn about a very different approach.
Good.
Well, thank you for coming in.
All right.
And there you have it, another episode of Multifaithful. We'd like to especially thank our guest, Zenju Earthly Manuel, for joining us in this interview and for sharing her thoughts. Again, her amazing book is called The Way of Tenderness. You can get yourself a copy and learn more about her thoughts on race, gender, and sexuality and multifaith. Additional thanks to all those who helped get this podcast off the ground. It's been a big undertaking, and many people in the office have been extremely helpful in that regard. I want to make a special thank you to Brian Young, one of our incredible student workers, who both joined me for the interview, but has also been editing, producing, giving thoughts, and being a general all-star around this podcast. Special thank you to Lynn Suados. The music is originally, she composed it for the Of Many film. And finally, thank you so much for listening to this podcast. I hope you enjoyed what what you heard. Again, this is Multifaithful, and I hope you stay tuned for our next episode coming soon.